Hey guys, just want to let you know the Patreon is up. Check it out, patreon.com/Beer City Media Podcast for all your extra Beer City Media needs. Now on with the show.
This morning, the music world is remembering grunge rock pioneer Chris Cornell. Cornell died unexpectedly late last night. He was in Detroit and he was 52 years old. His music career spanned more than three decades and he performed with a number of bands. This video is believed to be from his final show last night in Detroit, just hours before his death. Anthony Mason is here with a look at how Cornell changed rock music. Anthony, good morning.
Good morning. Just before that show at the Fox Theater in Detroit last night, Cornell tweeted out a picture of the marquee. He was in the midst of a month-long tour with Soundgarden, the band he fronted, which along with Nirvana and Pearl Jam were founding members of the Seattle grunge sound.
Last month, he told me he was working on a new Soundgarden album.
And how far away is the new Soundgarden album, do you think?
One of the things we did when we got back together was decide to never put a clock on what we do. Which I think has been really helpful in it just always being a positive experience.
And in the studio that day, he performed an acoustic version of perhaps Soundgarden's best-known song, Black Hole Sun.
Really extraordinary performance that day. This news has just stunned everybody. Came out of nowhere. 52 years old. He has three children. In a statement, his family says they'll be working with the medical examiner to figure out exactly what happened. No cause of death at this point.
He was just here in this studio.
He was in the studio
so
last
eerie,
month.
Anthony, yeah. That you would talk to him and then you get this news.
Yeah, and seemed in very good shape when he was here.
Great loss.
Real stunner.
Great loss.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Conspiracy Therapy Podcast with Ryan, Larry, and Spring Hill Josh. It's a special boys episode. And on today's episode, ladies and gentlemen, boys. Shit. Sorry. Oh, I'm getting COVID, folks. It's the conspiracy of Chris Cornell. Soup Kitchen Interwebs 2021. I can't see Larry. So usually that's my cues.
Sorry. I was sitting there like giving a thumbs up and no one could see it.
I could see it.
Oh, but yeah, Josh could see it.
So I'm going to just mimic everything that Larry does from here on out.
Okay.
Yes, welcome to this episode. We're doing a little do-over, but that's okay. And you don't need to see behind the curtain, all right?
Larry's a big fuck up. That's the
technically, I think this was a you and I fuck up.
It was an unknown fuck up. We didn't know there was a minimum write speed on our memory cards.
Damn it. Why is there always got to be a thing? Just one thing. Just one time.
Because that's podcasting.
Oh, that's
right. Pulling the curtain back, folks. Shit happens.
That's
a lot.
April will be back next week. Hey, man. Let me just take a little sip. How was you guys' week?
I've had better.
Very bad question.
I'm not too bad, actually. I mean, I'm counting down the time, actually, when this episode comes out, I'll be on vacation.
Vacation.
Nice. I've been looking forward to this vacation for, like, I don't know, 6 months. So
I hear that. You put in every year, like at the end of the year for your vacation?
Yeah, towards the end of the year, beginning of the year, somewhere in there.
Right on. I didn't know. With this whole fucking pandemic, it's always hard to guess. Like, last year, everything got canceled. So it's like perpetually canceled world.
You know, the thing that I don't get is I tell people, like, oh, yeah, I have this vacation. Like, you're doing anything? I'm like, well, yeah, we're still figuring that out. They're like, I can't believe you're going to go on vacation. I'm like, I still don't want to be here.
Right.
Like, you still need a break from work where you can just do the things that you want to do. Right. Even during a pandemic, God forbid, you just want to have some time home to see your kids and do fun stuff.
I had my first day off today in like a long, long, long time. And you know what I did? Batman and nap.
You did Batman?
Yeah. It's kind of
dirty Catwoman, you.
I'm on the mean streets of Gotham. What was that character that Larry had way back in the day? With Robin, down on his luck, Robin.
Oh, Meth Head Robin, yeah.
Yeah. That's who I was channeling today a little bit.
You were Meth Head Robin.
I don't meth around. So, anyways.
There's a killer joke.
That's what I'm trying to do. I've been reading your book. So, anyway, Chris Cornell, Truth Corner. All right. Oof, so, Jesus. Hey, there's a little smoke in the air. I'm sorry. Hey, let's get Truth Corner. Let's pull the Thunderbirds out of the road. All right. So, full disclosure, I love this band. This was easily his main band, Soundgarden, was one of the biggest influences on me at an early age. Josh, what's your experience with Chris Cornell and his music?
Well, I mean, I grew up with it, obviously. But my formative teen years were when he was with the ex-members of Rage Against the Machine in Audioslave. So, yeah, I'll admit that there's no denying the man was a phenomenal vocalist. Mm.
I think April mentioned offhand that he had a 5-octave range.
Yeah, something like that. It's insane. Could have I followed his career probably closer? Sure. When it comes to that 90s era of like alternative and grunge, I'll admit Soundgarden was not high up on that list at the time. You know, I was too busy listening to like Nirvana and Alice in Chains.
Same area too, right?
Like weren't Seattle
grunge. Larry, what about you?
I first got to know them on the Pump Up the Volume soundtrack, which I think came out in like 89 or 90.
Okay.
And then that cassette tape I owned. And I know they're not a very well known band, which makes me quirky and unique to like them, but...
Whoa there. No. Do you need to stop wearing your hipster hat there, know, Larry? Right?
But yeah, I mean, obviously, everything he did with them, Temple the Dog, his solo stuff, so the stuff he was doing with his daughter just before he passed away, which, by the way, is 4 years ago today of our recording. Yeah.
That's synergy, baby. The old recording had to die a slow hanging death so that we could re-record this on the anniversary of his death.
Yep. Happy little accidents.
Anyway, so big influence. I would say he played for me, specifically being a guitarist and wanting to be a songwriter.
Musician.
And one of the cool things too, I didn't say it. One of the cool things too about Chris Cornell is that I was listening to a documentary about him, actually, weirdly enough, after we did the episode.
But that's how it always happens.
It is. But literally, he was talking about how when he first started, he was a drummer.
And he played drums in like multiple bands. And literally one day he's like, all these bands suck. And like, there's no drive. And so eventually he just said, well, fuck it. I'll learn guitar and I'll play the songs that I want to play. And that's how he found his band.
I think that's a course that a lot of people end up taking, where you get frustrated with bands that you're playing with because they want to do a certain style of music. Mm-hmm. I know that firsthand, where you're like, man, they don't want to play the things I want to play. And that's the only thing you can do is like become a songwriter and walk that path.
I like
no
that.
No ifs, ands, or buts.
You two have like, you guys, cause like the first time I picked up a guitar, the first time I picked up a bass, you don't hear a lot of people saying the first time I picked up my drum machine.
I don't know about that. I wouldn't be surprised if there are a lot of people that are like you, where they were into like that hip hop and, you know, were like, oh, if the Beastie Boys, this is how they did it. And they look at how they sound.
Yeah.
Right.
I was going for a crummy joke there.
Hey, and man, but you're a multi-instrumentalist, so it's easy. I feel like, because that's what I did with Glassfield, was I basically was like, I made a bunch of demos and then I played them for people and they're like, well, fuck, I'd be in that band. So that's how I did it. My brother helped. So
I think a few bands have that, where the one person is kind of the songwriter, the lead songwriter. And mm-hmm. I mean, we could probably break down music all day long, but
for sure,
Lord knows we have.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's get into Cornell's early life. So he was born Christopher John Boyle on July 20th, 1964 in Seattle, Washington, where he was raised. His parents are Edward F. Boyle, a pharmacist of Irish Catholic descent, and Karen Cornell, an accountant of Jewish background and self-proclaimed psychic. Huh.
Did not know Chris Cornell was Jewish.
Yeah. After his parents divorced when he was a teenager, he and his siblings adopted their mother's maiden name, Cornell, as their surname. Cornell was one of six children. He had two older brothers and three younger sisters.
Do you always kind of like wonder what they ended up doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like with like famous like comedians and stuff too, because like, you had Charlie Murphy, you had Chris Farley's brother,
right? Kind of. Well, that's a whole other Chris Farley, a whole other thing. But most of the time, it's not like that, though. You know what I mean? Usually, the famous like who did Garth and what's his name?
Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey and Mike Myers.
Like his brother invented Toaster, which was like this video editing program back in the day. And he's also like I think he's also like a physicist or something. Like his brother is like super successful.
Wow.
But like nowhere near comedy.
Interesting. So it's almost like it takes a certain kind of psychopathy to become like a great comedian.
I think,
but that greatness could also be used in other things.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I always thought it was weird how you could have like, you could have brothers or like that, how one person is this like world-class singer and the other brother's like, I can't sing a note to save my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. You think perhaps it's genetic or it's probably just hard work more than anything.
Well, as we've talked about with serial killers, a lot of them is like that, the McDonald's triad where they hit their head or they piss the bed or they kill and hurt small animals. Like it all factors in. And so maybe like he's in a band and by him being in these like run of the mill bands, but you know, maybe having like this ego of like, I can do better is what drove him to kind of do it on his own.
Well, but Larry, no matter what, is right. There's a YouTuber musician. His name is Jared Dines.
One of his popular
videos is him going around and telling people to do a metal scream because everyone's like, oh, all they do is scream in this band. It sounds like shit. And he's like, okay, do it. So he just goes up to people like, do a metal scream, and like hardly anybody can do it. And the people that can, he's like, you've been a singer how long? And they're like, I've been practicing that metal scream for 4 years, or, you know, you just can't
Everything takes hard work.
That whole style of singing is so specialized. Like it I have tried it and it just tears my throat apart. So I know I'm doing it wrong. Mm.
Yeah, it is very hard to do that stuff. But you know, I've been jamming along to metal records for years, so like some of those gutturals I can do, but what? Not at first. Sounded like a pig squeal. Not the good kind.
One of my favorite early memories: me and my brother is driving him to Ann Arbor to audition for a metal band, and watching him do like screamy vocals, and I could tell they were kind of disinterested halfway through, even though they were running through all their songs on MySpace that they did. But by the very end, like, I couldn't help but be like awestruck by my brother's talent, even though I could tell they were just like,
he's not got tight enough pants
or whatever the hell they were looking for in a singer. But anyways,
I mean, yeah, if you're looking for an example of singing with no practicing, I've done my fair share of that on the show with
great results. All right, so Cornell attended Christ the King, a Catholic elementary school, where he performed for the first time in front of a crowd singing the 1960s anti-war song One Tin Soldier.
Sure, that went out well.
Yeah. He later attended... Yeah, can you imagine the conservative families there?
It's possible. I mean, there is some... there is some liberal Catholics out there. But the most part, not so much.
He later attended Shorewood High School, where he was in seventh... when he was in seventh grade, his mother pulled him and his sister out of Catholic school. Cornell claimed because they were about to be expelled for being too inquisitive.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be me.
I believe it. Yep.
He recalled the episode in a 1994 interview, quote, "With a religion like that, it's not designed for anyone to question. Being young people who have a natural curiosity and half a brain, you're going to start finding inconsistencies, which there are tons in organized religion. We both sort of made it clear in classroom situations that we didn't get it. Explain this to me. And they couldn't. So we started creating a lot of problems." Cornell traced his musical influences back to Little Richard via the Beatles. He spent a 2-year period between the ages of 9 and 11 solidly listening to the Beatles after finding a large collection of Beatles records abandoned in the basement of a neighbor's house.
Wow. Which,
who goes to their neighbor's house and like, oh, I'm going to find some hidden treasures in here. Oh, look at this Beatles Abbey Road.
A bored child does that, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd let my children go to my neighbor's house for one.
My dad,
let alone go in their basement.
My dad has a giant vinyl collection. I've gone through it. It's pretty impressive.
My dad sold all his vinyl. The prick.
Oh, I bet.
I wanted it so bad, and he's brought it up too. I'm like, because he was in the Navy and he bought all these vinyl records overseas when he was.
Oh,
my dad.
And like.
My dad did that in Vietnam. He actually brought back a stereo system that still works to this day.
Oh, I'm sure. That's because things built back then were built to last. Now, I'm convinced. I don't even know if it's true. This might be a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But I believe that technology, everything that's built now, is not built to last. It's built to last you for maybe a couple of years, and then it breaks so that you have to buy a new one.
The next variation.
I'll agree with you with that, except for cars.
I would say...
Cars nowadays, if you do the routine maintenance on a car nowadays, you can easily get 200,000 miles out of a car.
Sure.
But other than that, you're right. You buy a fridge, it's for 10 years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You buy a washer, dryer, 10, 15 years max.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would agree. Like, it's literally like I'm holding my vape pen, but I've gone through this thing, like these things, like maybe 5.
Well, the way you're coughing, I can see why.
Well, there's also like fundamentally, they don't make things. He's right, though. Like, for the price point, it makes sense that it's like everything's based on like you're going to buy the next thing when the next variation comes out.
I remember having a TV growing up that we dropped. It dropped on the ground and you pick it up and it still works fine. Nowadays, you drop a TV, you're praying before you pick it up, or like your phone, it hits the ground and before you look at the screen, you're like,
Lord Jesus, I don't talk to you often.
You become religious.
Indeed. So, during his teenage years, he spiraled into severe depression, dropped out of school, and almost never left the house. At the age of 12, he had access to alcohol, marijuana, LSD, psilocybin mushrooms, and prescription drugs.
God damn.
He used them daily by 13.
Did you guys, both of you, did you guys even try any drugs or alcohol by the time you were 13?
No.
I tried cigarettes. Like, I had a friend who got a pack from an older brother. And I remember we went down to, like, the river that ran through our town. And literally, like, the moment I tried it, I was like, this tastes like leaves. And I hated it.
Now, this is probably an older person thing.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wouldn't fly nowadays, but I do remember my father and my uncles would give me sips of beer when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And I hated it. I was like, this is gross. And then it wasn't until I was 18 when my parents, 17 or 18, when my parents went on a vacation and left me alone in the house. And I remember cracking a beer and maybe taking three sips and I was like, this is gross. And dumping it down the drain. And yeah. I didn't smoke weed until I was 20. Yeah, 20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was I tried weed in high school.
And even then, I was like, meh, no big deal. I didn't care for it that much.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I'm like you, Ryan. I want to say I was like 12 the first time I had a cigarette.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol was the same thing, like sips here and there. First time I smoked weed, though, I think would have been around 14 or 15.
Yeah, it was about the same for me.
Alcohol, actually, oddly enough, given the fact that I love beer, it wasn't a thing for me even when I went into the Navy. And probably about halfway through is when it was like, okay, we have nothing better to do but get trashed and watch DVDs and play Halo. So eventually it became an issue, but like, initially, I didn't even care. Like, I never even liked the taste. And I remember drinking that beer and being like, this hurts my stomach. Mm-hmm. Like, why would I drink this? Cornell took piano and guitar lessons as a child. He once explained that his mother saved his life when she bought him a snare drum, the instrument he adopted in beginning his path to becoming a rock star.
Something about that statement seems funny to me. Like... She buys him a snare drum and it saved his life. Like, what was he choking on a chicken bone? And she like chucked it at his stomach and popped it out of him. Like,
I mean,
I'm thinking that's just a good album title. A snare drum saved my life.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like choking on a drumstick.
Like one of those jazz greats, like Buddy Rich albums or whatever. Before becoming a successful musician, he worked as a busboy, as a dishwasher, as a fishmonger, at a seafood wholesaler, and was a sous chef at Ray's Boathouse in Seattle. I've been to Seattle, and I gotta say, it's a beautiful city. Hmm. I like the setup. It's like really, like, especially in the Pacific Northwest, you've got those big trees and like pine and all that, and it's just very, very, very pretty.
So you must have been there that one day the sun was out.
Yeah, it was pretty gray half the time, but yeah. there was a little bit of sun, and I remember I took we took a ferry back and forth from Seattle to another place, but I can't remember if it was a base or not. But anyways, yeah, I was just like, wow, I feel like I'm on a cruise, because like the landscape was just so pretty.
See, now I have my brother and his wife live pretty close to Seattle. It's funny. They actually live about, I think it was like 45 minutes from like Aberdeen, which is where Kurt Cobain was born and raised. And Seattle is like the same thing, like 45 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, I think you would like it here because there's a lot of things you can do. And I mean, we live in a part of the country where it's very religious and very country. But the problem with Seattle is he's like, yeah, everywhere you look, there's homeless people. It's really, really bad there.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that would be very depressing for me to see all those people and like knowing like, oh, it's raining 98% of the time and you have no shelter.
I mean, you could go downtown Grand Rapids and you'll see a lot of homeless as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. And then people yelling at him to get a job. And I'm like, you mean the guy that's talking to his stuffed animal about how he's going to ride his pet dinosaur back to his home galaxy of Glaxnar? You think he's going to hold down a 9-to-5-er?
Yeah, why isn't he flipping my burger, goddammit? Or the fact that he would walk in and try to get that job and they'd be like, oh, do you have 10 years experience doing this? No, do you have trying to get that experience. Well, you can't be hired if you don't have the experience. Or that's my favorite.
They have no address to put on a form.
That's the big thing. Yeah, no phone number.
Oh, boy.
How can we call you into work?
In the early 1980s, Cornell was a member of a cover band called The Shemps, which featured bassist Hiro Yamamoto and performed around Seattle.
I've seen a studio tour of his. He's a producer now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen he did a little. There's some YouTube channel that had producers give tours of their home studios, and it's fucking cool. A lot of guitars.
Interesting. After Yamamoto left the Shemps, the band recruited guitarist Kim Thayil. Cornell and Yamamoto stayed in contact, and after the Shemps broke up, the pair started jamming together, eventually bringing Thayil in to join them. Soundgarden was formed in 1984 by Cornell, Thayil, and Yamamoto, with Cornell originally on drums and vocals, the regular Phil Collins there. In 1985, the band enlisted Scott Sundquist as the drummer to allow Cornell to concentrate on vocals. Along with Nirvana, Alice in Chains, and Pearl Jam, Soundgarden quickly became one of the most successful bands from Seattle's emerging grunge scene in the early 1990s. I can remember Black Hole Sun being on MTV at the time as a kid.
That video was something else. I think we all can remember seeing that for the first time and the big googly eyes. And April mentioned the Barbie on the grill.
Melty Barbie.
Barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
Barbie on the Barbie.
I don't like that term, grunge. I don't care for it. I mean, it's a little too late, but...
Well, I mean, even Cobain always said that, like, because Nirvana's first record was a heavy metal record.
Right.
And then they always looked at everything after that as pop rock.
Yeah.
Well...
I mean, it is, grunge does tend to have a lot of hooks.
Yeah, well, even Alice in Chains, for some reason, is hooked in with grunge, and I'm like, no, they were like metal.
Metal, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting the way people clarify or classify. I feel like grunge has to do with the attitude of the time, too. Like, I'm picturing, like, grungy shirts and the long flannels
with the long johns underneath.
Oh, yeah.
Wore, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Torn jeans.
Yep. And my Doc Martens.
Dudes with long hair. Oh, Doc Martens.
Yep.
Worked a lot of hours at McDonald's to pick those fuckers up.
God. Yeah. While still in Soundgarden, Cornell recorded an album with members of what would become Pearl Jam. This collaboration went under the name Temple of the Dog, and the self-titled album was released in 1991.
I was very confused because I had bought that, and then I bought like Pearl Jam, and I'm like, but that sounds like the guy from Temple. Like, it really blew my mind because I didn't have the internet back then. I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, that record just celebrated its 30-year anniversary, and then there's so many great songs on there.
Yeah.
In 1998, Cornell began working on material for a solo album on which he collaborated with Elaine Johannes and Natasha Schneider of the band 11. Audio Slave was formed in 2001 after Zach De La Rocha left Rage Against the Machine and the remaining members were searching for another vocalist.
Which I gotta say, because when we originally did this episode, we couldn't remember why And after the episode was done, I looked into why Zach De La Rocha left Rage Against the Machine. And that was because he felt like their message they weren't taking the system down. So that was well, we're not doing anything.
It's funny you bring up their message, because I'm not sure if you saw, I think it was, less than a week ago. Rage put out a statement about the whole Israeli Hamas, Palestinian thing right now.
Oh, yeah.
And so many fans of theirs were taken up. They were pissed. They're like, why are they being political? Apparently they didn't know. Apparently they didn't get the message, and they were confused as to why they were on the on the liberal side of things.
Oh boy!
You listened to them for how long? You didn't know they were a political band?
How many people are probably like, yeah, I heard "Killing in the Name of," and that was a cool song. And
I think I think they just heard "Fuck you, don't tell." I won't do what you tell me, and just figured that was the entire message.
Yeah, exactly.
They're time travelers. They wrote it about wearing masks.
Well, I posted the other day on Facebook. I was like, the best thing about Rage Against the Machine is their message and it's still relevant. And now the worst part about Rage Against the Machine is the fact that their music is still relevant.
I mean, what machine did they think they were fucking raging against? The vending machine?
I wanted a Coke and give me a Pepsi.
Fuck you, I won't do what you tell
Fuck
me.
Fuck you,
Pepsi
I don't
machine.
Want D5. Fuck you, I don't want D5.
Damn it, my Twix is stuck in the top there. It didn't drop.
Yeah, that's what they wrote it about. That and your mom kicking
you out. They
rally
around the family with a pocket full of Smarties.
I'm just listening to Rage Against the Machine because my mom tried to tell me to empty the dishwasher.
So I whispered under my breath, "Fuck you! I won't do what you tell me."
Yeah, real quiet, because I don't want her hearing.
No, she'll feed me soap.
Yep. So producer Rick Rubin was the one who suggested that recruit Cornell. In 1985, Cornell started dating Susan Silver, the manager of Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, and Screaming Trees, and they married in 1990. They had a daughter, Lillian Jean, born on June 28th, 2000. Cornell and Silver divorced in 2004, and in 2004, he married Vicky Karayannis, I think is how you say it.
Okay, that's pretty good.
A Paris-based American publicist of Greek heritage. I was going to say it sounds a little Greek.
Bet she's hot.
I imagine. So the couple had a daughter together, Tony, in September 2004, and a son, Christopher Nicholas, in December of 2005. Cornell was a close friend of late singer Andrew Wood, who was his roommate in Seattle. Cornell was good friends with Pearl Jam frontman Eddie Vedder. Cornell was one of the first people that Vedder met outside his Pearl Jam bandmates after moving to Seattle in 1990. The two were neighbors for a while.
Now, whoever's the other roommate that didn't do anything, he's just an accountant somewhere.
Yeah.
He's just couch guy.
Couch guy. Yes.
Now, actually, I'm the branch manager of five Burger Kings.
Dude, that would make still the good money. Break you in a lot of money, dude. If you had five Burger King franchises under your belt, you'd be doing pretty good.
Yes. It isn't until you get to that point that you're making that kind of a great money. But
I mean,
actually, even store managers.
You have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, I own five Burger Kings, and it's an unbelievably bad franchise, but still.
This might be a money sink, but I'm still running five. Count them five.
It could be worse, Larry. It could be Long John Silver. So.
I just assume it's a guy in a I assume that thing's run by just one guy in a yellow slicker.
No, I always thought it was a fish that was it's been dead in its aquarium for ages.
It's literally
it's a fish with glasses
and a little tie.
Every branch manager of Long John Silver's is just the bad guy from I Know What You Did Last Summer, just hanging out in a freezer with a fucking hook hand and
the way decisions are made is they have like a mouth reader come in to this talking fish and it's just
oh my god.
Oh, what's that? We should have even faker tuna.
All those in favor say arr.
I mean, look, if you're going to work on the Long John Silvers, you might as well talk like a pirate all day. Come on, make this fun for both of us.
Mm-hmm. You're not a branch manager, you're a patch manager. Exactly. They wear eye patches. It's funnier when you have to explain the joke.
It is. Yar, and we're closed on Sundays for the Lord of the Sea.
They are too, aren't they? That's right.
The Lord of the Sea says, ye rest.
Mm-hmm. Our Lord and Savior Cthulhu?
Yeah, no. I know, right? No, shouldn't pirates' God be Cthulhu?
I think they pray to Cod.
Oh, Jesus Christ. This welcome to Fish Heaven. This is Cod. Mm-hmm. This is also your Jesus. God.
Oh, for Pike's sake. This is our tour guide Gil.
Oh, don't mind me. It's my first Jay and the Job.
Oh my god. Oh fudge.
Yep, this is the boys episode. Yep.
Indeed. We're gonna go on tangents. All right, so now Cornell, we're gonna talk a little bit about what happened here, and then after this we'll take a break. So Cornell struggled with depression and had multiple addictions, mostly alcohol and prescription druggies, which are no good. Do you guys know anybody who's had struggles with pain pills and stuff like that? You don't have to say who, but I'm just saying, like,
yeah, somebody
too.
A friend of mine, she got addicted to Vicodin, and started missing a lot of work, and so, but thankfully, she went to rehab and cleaned herself up.
Yeah. Those are tough to break too, because it's not like you know the chemicals and some of these new drugs. So
I mean, I've taken Vicodin and like I didn't care for it. Like I had a pinched nerve in my back, and they gave it to me, and I took it. And the only thing I could concentrate on television wise, because that's pretty much all you can do at that point, was the Teletubbies. I swear to God, I just watched hours of the Teletubbies while eating these pain pills.
Holy shit, that baby son is talking to me. It's telling me to kill myself.
I feel like you're like, just like in your head, you're just kind of floating above the couch or the bed while you're watching the show, and you're just thinking to yourself, I bet that purple one's gay.
You do kind of have a floaty feeling about yourself.
Wasn't that the controversy with that, though? The Teletubbies, the purple one, yeah, was supposed to be...
Yeah, the purple one was the gay... Those, I don't know. It was, like, because Prince... I don't know. Like, they had this whole convoluted thing that the square on his head represented the gay flag, and he was purple, and Prince wore purple, and I don't know. It was really weird.
I appreciate inclusivity and them trying to approach that sort of thing, but it's just funny how those things like slowly started to like,
you know what it probably was? It was some redneck that saw some kid watching it like, this shit, this is for them gay folk. And I don't want to say the F word because it's no different than these assholes. They're like, oh, that Marilyn Manson, you know, he removed a rib so he could suck his own dick.
Or at least
he's got titties now. Did you see that damn music video?
That's awful. But what in the Dale Jr. is going on here?
I always think to myself, when somebody says, or wherever those rumors sparked from, those are those secret guys. Those secret gay guys who are really fighting it, like the conservative ones who are like, literally, let's punish them for...
They're finding any reason for something to have homosexual tendencies, and it's like, no, it's a kid's show. Yeah. They're not... And even if there was something in there, Why do you care?
Right.
The guy wrote Teletubbies like, dude, you could put way more thought into this than I did. I wrote this script in 3 fucking minutes.
Yeah, I know.
I put shapes on their heads because they're fun shapes.
Yeah. Today's
episode is... I was looking at my PlayStation controller and there was an X, a zero, a square, and a triangle.
Yeah, this episode's real enthralling. The sun baby face kid shows up and then the purple one runs over a hill and there's like music. That's it. Dude, it's not rocket science.
I hit my bong and I was like, let's turn a vacuum cleaner to a spaceship, baby.
I mean, it's no different than watching like Yo Gabba Gabba.
Yeah. Oh my God. Anyway, well,
you know, I talk about a show that you do not watch when you're really, really fucked up. Don't watch Yo Gabba Gabba.
Noted.
Anyway, so he had issues with that, the drugs and the booze. So in 97, when Soundgarden disbanded and his first marriage was falling apart.
It was 97?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ.
And that was when Cornell turned to Oxycontin and other substances.
Baby.
He said about that period, quote, I went through a serious crisis with depression where I didn't eat a whole meal every day. I was just kind of shutting down. I eventually found that the only way out of that was to change virtually everything in my life. That was a very go ahead.
Oxycontin, you say? I could could lose some weight. No, but in all seriousness, he's trying to treat his depression with depressants, and that just does not end well.
Nope.
Mm-mm.
So he said that was a very frightening thing, but it was worthwhile. So when he changed everything in his life, he checked into rehab in 2002 and quit drinking and smoking around 2005. What were you going to say, Josh?
I was just going to say, like, you got to applaud him for that, to realize that to get away from this life, mm-hmm. you have to walk away from all of it mm-hmm. at once. And I mean, thankfully, well, he had the money. Mm-hmm. So that he could, you know, check into rehab and not have to worry about missing a paycheck, you know, and losing his home or whatever.
Right.
But to realize that these drugs are not helping me, the drinking's not helping me, this is what I have to do and it's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And, you know, without getting to the verdict, I mean, we know what happens and there's a lot of that for people. It's a constant struggle to hold up what looks like a sturdy thing is actually just a house of cards waiting to fall.
Mm-hmm. Just keep trying, keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. Even if you fail, keep trying, keep trying,
exactly.
keep trying.
And I think more often than not, people don't understand that it's okay to hit speed bumps.
And that's the thing. I think people think, oh, well, you've got 3 years under your belt. You're good to go. People like relapse 20 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's a famous comedian I listened to on a podcast who had a relapse like a year ago during COVID. Yeah. You know, it hits you.
I mean, I don't know how many times over the years I quit smoking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it'd be good for different times, a month, 6 months, a couple of years, 5 years. And it would always creep its way back in.
Mm. But you kept trying.
That's the important thing is that you do keep trying because you know it's something that you don't want to do anymore.
Yep. Agreed. Cornell stated in a 96 interview, quote, I know what it feels like to be suicidal and I know what it feels like to be hopeless. There is some point where I learned enough about myself to know that I don't have the tolerance to create other hurdles as well. In 1999, Cornell said the following about depression. Quote, no one really knows what run-of-the-mill depression is. You'll think somebody has run-of-the-mill depression, and then the next thing you know, they're hanging from a rope. It's hard to tell the difference. But I do feel that depression can be useful. Sometimes it's just chemical. It doesn't seem to come from anywhere. And whenever I've been in any kind of depression, I've over the years tried to not only imagine what it feels like to not be there, but try to remind myself that I could just wake up the next day and it could be gone because that happens and not to worry about it. And at the same time, when I'm feeling great, I remember the depression and think about the difference in what I'm feeling and why I would feel that way and not be reactionary one way or the other. You just have to realize that these are patterns of life and you just go through them.
That's dark.
Yeah, it's dark.
But hopeful.
There's some hope to it, but it's sad to think that, like, even in your best moments, you can be brought down. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you have these defining moments in your life. You met April, you have kids together, you get your first, when you made regular, those sort of things, like those big pivotal moments, just to always have a dark cloud is fucking dark to think about. At the age of 12, Cornell had access to alcohol, marijuana. I think we had this issue in the last episode.
I mean, that's insane that he was able to score weed at the age of 12.
Yeah. And PCP. He had a bad PCP experience. He suffered from panic disorder and agoraphobia because of this panic.
Good God.
That's from...
You know what, though? Honestly, I think about when I was 12... Because, gosh, that puts you at, like, 7th, 8th grade? 7th grade, 8th? Yeah, something like that.
About 7th, yeah, 6th or 7th.
I feel like if I really had wanted that, I could have gotten it.
Mm. Wow.
Because think about it, you probably had friends that had, like, older brothers or sisters. Mm-hmm. So, like, even though it's something you wasn't in your brain at the time, like, I want to try that. Mm-hmm. You're like, it's still... something you probably could have gotten your hands on.
So with regards to this PCP freakout moment, it said, it's not like you go to your dad and doctor and say, yeah, I smoke PCP and I'm having a bad time. So I became more or less agoraphobic because I'd have flashbacks from 14 to 16. I didn't have any friends. I stayed home most of the time up till then. Life was pretty great. I never did any drugs until my late 20s. Unfortunately, being a child of two alcoholics, I started drinking a lot, and that's what eventually got me back into drugs. You often hear that pot leads to harder drugs, but I think alcohol is what leads you to everything because it takes away the fear. The worst drug experimentation I ever did was because I was drunk and didn't care. He's got a good point.
Very good point.
I mean, somewhere in that, not quite that bad, but I mean, being drunk has led me to eat like entire pizzas by myself, which is not something I would ever do normally.
So when you get that pizza and you're like, all right, I need another beer because no fear, baby. Here we go in my belly.
It clouds your judgment for sure. Like, I've never had my judgment clouded by marijuana ever.
All I've ever done really is just laugh or cough too much.
I can't, you know, I'm not as useful on it as, you know, like I would never show up on a show high because I know I'd be completely useless, but I'm not out of control.
Right. Of course. Yeah. No. And there's a lot of people who take that. I've known who can take things. It's all about tolerance. You want to try to walk a fine line or not. You want to be smart about it.
I mean, like it or not, and you can be pro weed, which I am, but you're not as sharp as you are sober, period.
Right. Of course. And I think that's kind of what he's getting to here as well. Basically saying, like, it's taking away. It's kind of like, a lot of people nowadays, I think it's just common to just drink coffee, to have certain things that you do that you just inherently do. And it's like, I don't know. Some people think of beer and alcohol that way. And I feel like that whole idea and concept needs to be changed. So
this episode brought to you by Budweiser.
Bud.
If you don't think the alcohol companies are, you know, clouding your judgment with how they advertise and how they push their product, they make it seem totally normal to get lit like every night.
Right. Which it's not. Don't do that. Mm-mm. In May 2007, Cornell was honored with the Stevie Ray Vaughan Award for his dedication and support of the Music Cares MAP Fund and his devotion to helping other addicts with the recovery process. Oh, the award was presented by Alice Cooper. Nice.
A recovering alcoholic as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, you're right. When asked how he beat his addictions, Cornell stated it was a long period of coming to the realization that the sober way is better. Going through rehab honestly did help. It got me away from just the daily drudgery of depression and either trying to not drink or do drugs or doing them. And, you know, they give you such a simple message that any idiot can get, and it's just over and over. But the bottom line is really, and this is the part that is scary for everyone, the individual kind of has to want it. Not kind of. You have to want it and to not do that crap anymore, or you will never stop, and it is just going to kill you. There's nothing you can do. If your best friend has a problem and it's very serious, there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. And it was sad for me and the people around me, sad for me when friends of mine died because of it, unquote. In a 2011 interview, Cornell said the major change when Soundgarden reformed was a lack of alcohol. He said, quote, "The biggest difference I noticed, and we haven't even really talked about it, there are no bottles of Jack Daniels around or beers, and we never talked about it. It's just not there," which is great.
That says a lot. I mean, I know we've all been jamming. We've jammed with other people, and that's like, that's always a staple. And it's mm-hmm. kind of messed up because like Larry said, you are the sharpest when you are sober.
Right.
But like you go to band practice and like you got one guy who's smoking a joint. Mm-hmm. You got some guy who's got a bottle of liquor and they're just getting wasted. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, I can't say that I wasn't part of that as well. Like, you know, show up and have a six pack of beer with me. And, you know, it's stupid because you're like, oh, if you're here to make music and do the best that you can, why would you get sloshed and
fuck that up?
And that kind of happened with my brother and I, my younger brother and I were, you know, an electronic band duo, whatever you want to call it. And he just wanted to be high all the time. And it's like, you're not bringing anything to the table. I mean, like, it's just kind of, you're like 2 seconds behind everything, I think, when you're high.
Yeah.
Which is fine. You know, if you're sitting on the couch watching a movie, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're there, when it comes to music or this podcast or whatever, it's you're coming to work.
I get that. Yeah. There's always the, especially like Josh, I was thinking of some of the more intense moments where that's happened with alcohol. And it's like, if you're going to band practice and spending the night because it's safer to stay there than to drive home. There was a lot of that. And I was there. I would nap in my car sometimes because we would just get rip roaring.
Wow.
Oh yeah, dude. We would do it during the day or, you know, in the afternoon even, and it would be like, fuck it. Let's just party. Halfway through, it's like, well, we're playing some horrible music at this point, so might as well just stop. So yeah, it sucks. It happens. It's not fun.
And then in your head, you're like, that was awesome. Then the next day you play the tape. You're like, what the fuck?
I know.
Oh, yeah.
Is this playing backwards? What the hell is going?
Are you playing your guitar with marbles?
No, those are my teeth.
You were playing a different song than we all were.
Yeah. Yeah, that's rough. But anyway, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we got more things to talk about in the Deathspiracy. See you on the other side.
This morning, shock and sadness over the death of Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell. The medical examiner in Detroit said that Cornell, considered one of the architects of the 1990s subgenre of alternative rock, also known as grunge, killed himself by hanging after performing at a concert Thursday. But the family of Cornell, who was found dead in his Detroit hotel room, issued a statement through an attorney refuting inferences that Chris knowingly and intentionally killed himself. The family saying that without toxicology tests completed, they can't be sure what led to his death or if any substances were involved. Overnight, tributes pouring in. In Seattle, the city's famed Space Needle went dark for an hour. Celebrities sent condolences via social media. Elton John tweeting, "Shocked and saddened by the sudden death of Chris Cornell, a great singer, songwriter, and the loveliest man." Billy Idol writing, "Sad to hear of Chris Cornell passing, great singer and artist, another blow, R.I.P. and from former band member Tom Morello, a eulogy reading in part, "I love you, brother. Thank you for your friendship and your humor and your intellect and your singular and unmatched talent. Your beautiful voice and beautiful self will always be in my heart. God bless you and your family." According to the Cornell family's lawyer, he had a prescription for an anti-anxiety drug, which he said has various side effects. In their statement, Cornell's wife said she spoke to him after the show, and he told her he may have taken an extra pill or two. Guys.
Chanel, thank you very much.
The sun refused to shine, I would still be loving you. If mountains crumbled to the sea, there would still be you and me. Kind woman, I give you my heart. Kind woman, nothing more. Little drops of rain, whispers of the pain, tears in love lost in.
Second segment, Tim, hanging out with Josh, Larry on the interwebs.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Christopher Cornell. Cornell? My friend
Cornelumbus.
Shout out to my friend Adam, also a listener, went to Cornell University. Good school, I hear.
Isn't that one of them Ivy League schools?
Yes. Yep. He's a smart cookie. Not like yourself, but I'm going to guide this ship somehow. Anyway, Josh, do you have your stuff?
I
was worried there for a second. I was like, oh, well, God.
End of show. Thank you for showing up.
Verdict. So and
he died and stuff.
Well, his last performance was here in Detroit Rock City. I actually watched the video. Have you seen that footage from that final performance, Larry?
No.
It's pretty sad, I will say. I watched it and they're singing, there's just this really, I mean, the conspiracy people who look at it, I'm sure can see certain things, but like, to me, it seems like he's really sad.
Which we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Okay. Indeed. So let's talk about this guy that we all know is dead.
Okay. That's fun.
Yes.
R.I.P.
So around 12:15 a.m. on May 18, 2017, Cornell's bodyguard found him unconscious in the bathroom of his hotel room 1136 at the MGM Grand in Detroit, Michigan.
I've stayed there a few times for union stuff.
Oh, nice place.
Very nice. Very, very nice. I actually got to stay in the penthouse the last time I was there.
Oh,
I know. I felt fancy. Tie just roller. Myself. I didn't even have to share the room with anybody.
Did you have like a jacuzzi in there?
No jacuzzi.
Did you have a mini fridge?
I did have a mini fridge, but I stayed away from that thing. The bar downstairs was much cheaper.
Yeah, fair enough.
You even move things in those mini fridges and they like charge you.
What, a moving fee?
No, they charge you for using. Like, I guess it's all electronically done and they automatically charge your room if you move something.
Oh God!
My luck would be my children to be like, oh, look at this stuff, rattle.
Yeah,
just dump everything out.
$500 later,
looks like Dad's getting lit tonight.
Yeah, you paid for it. You might as well.
All right.
Exactly.
But yeah, he played at the MGM after, and it was with Soundgarden, and they played at the Fox Theater on May 17th.
So that was a Soundgarden concert then, huh?
Yes.
Wow. So it was packed. I mean, they were on a big boom. They put out a new album.
That means he had his friends with him.
Oh yeah,
man.
Yeah. It, what's crazy, because before that he had done a big acoustic solo tour, which a buddy of mine went to and was like, oh yeah, it was fucking amazing. Sure. So yeah, he played with Soundgarden at the Fox Theater on the May 17. Now, the bodyguard found him. He was laying on the floor with an exercise band around his neck and blood in his mouth. An MGM medic and EMS personnel were unable to revive him. Cornell was pronounced dead by a doctor at 1:30 a.m. at the age of 52. The official cause of death was suicide by hanging. Police ruled out foul play by reviewing a hotel surveillance video, which showed nobody entering or exiting the suite after Cornell's bodyguard left at around 11:35 p.m. Something to think about for that verdict.
Indeed.
On July 2nd, 2017, the Wayne County Medical Examiner released its autopsy and toxicology reports in the death of Cornell. The medical examiner confirmed that the cause of death was hanging and the manner of death was ruled as suicide, adding that Cornell's injuries were all, quote, consistent with hanging, partially suspended by the resistance exercise band, and that drugs did not contribute to the cause of death. Only prescription medications and therapeutic doses were found in Cornell's system. The sedative, oh boy, Buddha Vital.
Buddha Vital.
Buddha Vital.
Yes, I spoke the Buddha Vital.
Oh boy, this is going to get interesting. I'm looking down. Oh boy. 5.4 milliliters.
Probably milligram.
That's the one commonly prescribed for the treatment of headaches. 44 doses of the anti-anxiety medication lorazepam, also known as Ativan.
Yeah.
The decongestant pseudoephedrine.
Sudafed.
Yes.
Is the brand name.
And it's metabolite.
Metabolite.
Norsufodurine.
Mark that.
I could be reading this and looking at these, but I just want to watch you suffer a little.
Which was caffeine from No Doz tablets that Cornell had ingested. And why are you doing this to me? Naloxone. It's like Four Loko, I guess, used to reverse opioid overdoses.
Oh, hold on. So why would he have a drug that reverses opioid?
Which was reportedly administered by emergency personnel upon their arrival at the scene.
Gotcha. They were like, Rockstar, better prick him.
Hey, Fred, grab the Drano. We got another rock star on our hands.
It's like they just walk in the room, walk up to him, stab him, then start asking questions.
They pull out a kid, just says rock star on it.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, we were just on the 24th floor. That's where we had to help Richard Gere with his hamster.
So here's the interesting thing about that. Yeah. I just listed all these medications that they said that was in his system. Yet, according to this, no pills were found in Cornell's stomach. Mm-hmm. Cornell's widow stated that the Ativan was prescribed to him in 2016 as a sleep aid. Photos from Cornell's hotel room showed that his prescription for Ativan was one tablet every 12 hours. Cornell's widow contacted insurance lawyer Kirk Pasich within a few minutes after her husband's death, which is kind of strange. Pasich became the spokesperson for the widow and blamed Ativan for the singer's death, stating that Cornell would not intentionally take his own life. Cornell's widow said, quote, when we spoke after the show, I noticed he was slurring his words. He was different. When he told me he may have taken an extra Ativan or two, I contacted security and asked him that they check on him. Following the release of the autopsy and toxicology report, Cornell's widow released a statement to the press. Quote, many of us who know Chris well noticed that he wasn't himself during his final hours.
and that something was very off. We have learned from this report that several substances were found in his system. After so many years of sobriety, this moment of terrible judgment seemed to have seemed completely impaired and altered his state of mind. Something clearly went terribly wrong, and my children and I are heartbroken and are devastated that this moment can never be taken back. We very much appreciate all of the love we have received during this extremely difficult time and are dedicated to helping others and preventing this type of tragedy, end quote. So Cornell publicly talked about his struggle with depression, as we know, isolation and suicidal thoughts. This started after he had taken the PCP, as Ryan had mentioned earlier, and how it, like, he took it and it like changed him.
Mm-hmm.
It left a deep scar on his psyche, as he would say down the line. He became an introvert, experienced anxiety and depression. Now,
he was agoraphobic.
Yep. Now, following Chris's death, his older brother, Peter Cornell, started a campaign to raise awareness of depression and suicide prevention. A few days later, Peter revealed that he was being bullied and threatened to change the narrative of his awareness message, stating, quote, "This bullying is coming from a place I never could have imagined." In October 2017, Peter reacted to criticism directed at him on social media by his brother's mother-in-law, so his wife's mom. He talked about the stigma surrounding mental illness and the addiction narrative being spun by his brother's widow and her family to explain Cornell's death, stating, and that word, well, stating, quote, "And there is that word again, stigma. Somehow it's sexy to be an addict." Of which he himself was familiar. But let's not talk about mental illness, stigma. There are those who re-victimize and bully us, taunt and demand us to relive and tell the details of our painful upbringing. To what end? It doesn't erase the damage done. It doesn't turn back the hands of time. We are survivors.
It's so true. We openly talk in this country about physical exercise, the physical things you do to keep yourself in shape, to keep yourself happy and feeling good. But when it comes to mental side of things, we don't discuss that as what you can do to keep your brain healthy.
Right.
Right.
And I think in our generation too, we were kind of raised with that, like, buck up.
Someone's got worse than you. That's the thing I always heard.
Or, oh, you had it hard? Well, you didn't have to walk uphill 2 miles to school.
Thank you for negating my own fucking feelings. I mean,
it's true. It's true.
Now, so I kind of want to talk about, and it's funny because I had this from when we originally did this episode. Mm-hmm. I had all this stuff, but I'm going to just put that aside. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the supposed conspiracies involved with this whole thing, because there are conspiracies that are out there. There are a lot of people that believe that this was not a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
One of the statements that came out was that they say that in the security footage that the bodyguard, you see him go in, he's the last one to leave Chris's room until they find him dead. Right. So there are theories that the bodyguard was hired by Chris's wife, actually killed him and staged it as a suicide.
Was she the one to hire him?
That's according to what I had seen. Yes.
I mean, did they cite sources?
That I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, I'm curious. But
they say that I think her name Wendy.
Yeah,
this is where it kind of makes you mad as somebody, even though we're a show that does conspiracies. They link her to Courtney Love somehow, saying that they're friends and that because they were friends, and we know that Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, they were kind of on the outs. They were, you know, probably heading towards divorce. Supposedly that was kind of the path that
Chris.
It was Vicky. Sorry.
Vicky. Sorry. There's people that say Chris and Vicky were on that path as well, and that probably Courtney was like, oh, hey, I have a way you can take care of this. And so she had her husband killed so that she can, you know, still have all that money.
Well, she did sue Soundgarden over royalties.
Yes. Well, that's also because there's unreleased music that they wanted to put out or that they were refusing to put out, I think it was. But there was also a tribute concert that Soundgarden, the remaining members of Soundgarden, sued her because they did this big show, like a memoriam type show for Chris. And Vicky took all the money. She has not given any money to any of the band members, which I get. That's his family. Those are his kids. Maybe I would think that if you guys are probably rich already, let the family that just lost their husband, their dad, you know, that's money that they could put away for those kids.
In their defense, it's possible, and I have zero proof of this, that they had some sort of contractual obligation to pay them. I don't know. But to me, this always sounds misogynistic to me, that the woman was going to get divorced, therefore she murdered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a whole other, you know, that's a verdict thing we can get into later.
Right. Now, there is the biggest conspiracy involved here by far. This also ties into Chester Bennington, who died shortly after as well, under the same circumstances, who was a longtime friend of Chris as well, and the singer of Linkin Park. Supposedly, there was a big investigation that was going on Epstein, whom I'm sure at some point we will cover as well.
I would imagine.
He, of course, had this underground sex ring for involving children. And I guess Chris Cornell was a big supporter of this group, and they were making a documentary about it that was going to expose Epstein and, well, all the people involved. And we've heard some pretty big names that were supposedly involved with Epstein. So the conspiracy is that they wanted to shut him up. They wanted to take the money out of this project. And so that was that they had him murdered so that he could not contribute money to it. And then the reason why Chester was soon after was because he was right there with Chris supporting this project.
Understood.
Which, again, I feel almost like at the cost of, like, we're going to have our own verdict when it comes to the death of Chris and what his ties were with that. But I feel like when we inevitably do an episode on Epstein and this supposed sex ring, we'll have different things to say about that.
Yeah,
probably.
I feel like those are two totally different things.
Yes. Definitely.
I'd agree.
So, yeah, there's a lot of conspiracies. These are the conspiracies about him and how he may have actually been murdered. But I feel like this would be a good time to switch on over to a verdict.
I would agree. And I think it is time for a verdict. Yes. In one corner. Three. But the fourth is with us in
spirit,
solidarity in her heart.
She's with us as in the same way that she's also snuggling with my pillow upstairs in bed, probably.
Oh, well, we're here to suss out whether or not we think this. Did he get murdered or was it suicide? Where do we fall on this?
To me, this is pretty cut and dry. He's talked about suicide and he's talked about depression so many times over the years. We know that he accidentally took a couple extra Ativans. I may have forgot to mention that, but oh well. Hey, it's right here. He accidentally took extra.
You did mention that he took two.
Oh yeah, okay.
Don't worry.
And Ativan already fucks you up.
pretty bad. Yeah. I don't even want to think of what it would be like to have extra. Mm-hmm. So all these medications working against him, he may have been depressed because, or, you know, he had depression. Maybe he was thinking about his supposed marriage is kind of on the rocks, and
yeah,
maybe he's sad for other things. It doesn't matter. I think the guy accident. I think he killed himself.
Yeah,
it feels like all the fingers are pointing at the fact that he killed himself. It sucks.
It does.
You know, it's hard.
Yeah.
But I think that's where I stand on it.
Larry,
I think the Ativan thing was done on purpose. I think he needed that to get to a place where he could do this, to mentally maybe forget about his family, forget about his mm-hmm. friends, and just get himself into a relaxed state, because I think he'd already decided.
Yeah.
I would say he probably decided before that show that this was the last show. Because lifelong struggle, depression, I mean,
substance abuse issues.
The career was not what it used to be. Maybe that was something that we don't know. We don't know what the fuck's in his head.
Right. And I'm going to round it out by saying I agree with my co-hosts. I feel like at some point we talked about this, and maybe it was before, but there was definitely a feeling from the other band members that, you know, they didn't believe in any conspiracy. And those are the people that I feel like you really gotta look to as far as who that Chris really was. You know, these are the people with him longer, much longer. I mean, 1984, that is when they started. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lifelong thing. And you know, I have lots of different varying friends and different levels of depression, anxiety, you name it, substance abuse program problems. People who've been to rehab, people who haven't, and you know, there's all varying degree of people, but those long-term friendships, I mean, I feel like they're gonna know the best.
Tom Morello, when he was asked about it, he said the only sinister hand at work in his passing was his lifelong addiction that finally caught up with him.
Yeah.
And Kim Thayil, when asked about all the conspiracy theories, says it was a cockamimi ideas.
Right. No, I that's where I fall to. I feel like you would know, and the exercise band, I mean, that sounds like it's pretty painless, you know, for the most part.
Especially if you've taken a couple Ativans.
Exactly. And rest in peace, Chris. You freaking ruled, man. It's too bad. And that's your verdict. All right. Well, that's an episode, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls out there in the interwebs. We always start off with mentioning our Patreon in the beginning of the episode. But if you'd like to join our Facebook group, closed Facebook group, or like us on the tweets at Conspiracy T Show, Larry Gaga.
Actually, it's now Larry the Skeptic on Twitter.
Oh, nice.
Owning it. That's right.
I might add that on Facebook there is a page, Conspiracy Therapy page, and then there's a Conspiracy Therapy group.
That's true.
Join both. I think it's the page is our like official page, but the group is where all the fun is.
It is. It's a playground.
Yeah, we don't. We talk. We pretty much comment on everything that goes on there, and it's fun. And if you don't like Facebook, again, I mentioned Twitter and also Instagram. Mm-hmm. You can like us on there, and we post things. I try to be regularly posting things, but then sometimes I forget
because we have lives. Oh man!
Oh fudge. I mean, I'd say, does anybody have anything to throw out there?
I do.
Oh shit.
I just want to throw a final Chris Cornell quote out there. I think is very interesting.
Okay.
He once said, "There's something about losing friends where it's not something that you get over, I don't believe there is a healing process.
No.
Man.
Yeah.
Oh, Ryan.
Yeah.
I'm getting a call into my board right now.
Oh, God.
Should we answer it?
Sure, answer it.
Hey, it's the juice. Just wanted to tell you right now, with the virus going on, you should go get stabbed in the arm with a full syringe of vaccine. And also, with today's social climate, I just want to let everyone know we're all equal and we all love each other. And I want to make this statement right now. Ex-wives matter.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Well, thanks, Juice. I really appreciate you coming on the show and really spelling it for us.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, anyways, we'll see you next week in another episode of Conspiracy Therapy Podcast. Have a great one, guys.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your
a presentation of Beer City Media.